Hi, this is Lady C.
Hey, this is JT.
And in the upcoming video, we're going to be talking about Jehovah's Witnesses and conventions.
You're listening to The Critical Thought, where we challenge our listeners to use critical thinking when examining the teachings of Jehovah's Witnesses.
You know, both of us, we've attended a lot of conventions since the time we were kids. Lady C, tell me about what do you remember about going to the conventions? Both as a young person, child, right into your adulthood?
Well, what I do remember about the assemblies, there's just so much that happened. I remember, first of all, assemblies going from like early in the morning to 9 o'clock at night. I remember those assemblies, conventions, actually. I remember them serving food. Our meals were served at the conventions. I remember having to stay overnight at different conventions. I remember whenever they had a new publication that was being released and how a lot of people would leave their seat before the song and prayer to go stand in line so they could be one of the first persons to get the release. But one of the things that I do remember, my last year in high school, and I was so frustrated because I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. And I knew I did not want to pioneer at the time, because at that point in time, that just wasn't something that was near and dear to my heart. And I was so frustrated because no one was giving me any direction. Nobody was saying, you know, you should do this. Maybe you might want to do that. And I knew when I got to the assembly what they were going to be saying. Mm-hmm. They were going to be like, I know this is your last year of high school. Have you got your application yet to pioneer? And when I got to that convention during my last year of high school, that summer, that was the talk. And I remember sitting at my seat saying, I don't want to pioneer. You know, I was like, give me something else. Because everybody can't do that. You can't take care of yourself pioneering. And so then my decision was not to go to college, but my decision in my family was to send me to a business school for 6 months to give me some kind of training so that I could get a job. But that's what I settled for. But I knew when I got to that convention, it was going to be all about giving me more Watchtower stuff to do. And I knew I didn't want to do that.
Yeah, it's pretty much the standard. I guess for myself, what I remember about the convention as a kid, going to my teenage years, and into my adult life, was that the talks were always boring. Oh my God, the talks were just boring. And I couldn't figure out, because I used to ask. I used to stay in trouble because I asked too many questions. I used to ask because we knew brothers who were basically, you know, dynamic speakers, but they never won the convention. They never, ever put a lot of these brothers in the convention. They would bring these sad brothers out there every time. Jesus Christ. And you see the friends just dozing off, just especially after lunch. They just pass out. Well, it wasn't until I became an adult, went to Bethel, left, became an elder, and became involved in regional assemblies and conventions and circuit assemblies functions. I became part of those organizational structures. Did I finally understand why you have the speakers that you have out there? And unfortunately, it has very little to do with the brother's ability to teach. Has very little to do with the brother's ability to hold the attention of the audience. You would think that the society would want their best speakers who could hold the attention of an audience of 10, 12, 15,000 people. No. Basically, district assembly time is payback time. It's time to reward the brothers who are good society men, good branch men, follow instructions well. Has nothing to do with that. Has a lot to do with who you are friends with, who you're connected with. This is a business. I've always said that. And Lady C and myself, we got a chance to see it from the inside out. There was one assignment I had that it was unreal. Because I had been brought up as a witness kid a certain way, like most of us have. But I saw literally on the other side of the curtain. And it ain't nothing, as they said, it ain't nothing like it is on the side that most witnesses are on. What happened was, in this on the circuit level, I was the circuit assembly account servant. And what happens is, you know, we circuit A, circuit B, whatever. So during the summer, what ends up happening is the circuit overseer and the district overseer, they invite you to be a part of the district or the regional accounting office. And so what happened for me after doing that, I was then invited to be a part of the chairman's office. And that's where the movers and the shakers are in. They're in the chairman's office. Members of the governing body, they're there. The circuit district overseers at the time, they're there. Local city overseers, they're there. Missionaries, whoever is someone is there. And I got invited because I was friends with the circuit overseer. And he asked me, he says, I got a letter. And the letter invited me to be a part of the chairman's office. And my assignment was to be a reader. I'm like, a reader? What does a reader do? You know? And so I'm saying, like, what does a reader do? And so we were told that we could bring our wife to the chairman's office in this particular incident. And at the moment we got there, we realized that this was a different world. What happens is for, you know, and I was one of those, so I know. My wife knows. The average Jehovah's Witness is sitting out in the sun, especially if it's outdoors. You're sitting out in the sun beating down on you. You get the little umbrella in some cases. Sometimes the brothers don't want you to use the umbrellas and put tents over you. And so you sit out there sweating. I mean, you sweating. You suited and booted, but you sweating. Well, the chairman's office is typically up in the booths, up in the box seats, where people who have serious contracts with the stadiums, organizations, companies, they have their offices up there, you know, doing sporting events. Well, the society puts the chairman's office up there, and so that's where we were at. So the brother's giving us the number of where the chairman's office is going to be at. We go there, and when we get there, there are two brothers standing outside, their security. So we let the brother know, you know, I'm working in the chairman's office today, and, you know, so on and so on. So the brother said, hold on. So they open the door. Oh, we got Brother JT out here, you know. And so they invite us in. And so when my wife and I, we walked in, there's all the circuit overseers wives, chairman's wives, governing body wives, and we were literally the youngest couple up in the chairman's office. And I'm going to tell you, I just felt literally out of place. And Lady C, she'll share with you her personal experience in being in the chairman's office as well. But I just felt out of place. So my assignment was to be a reader. And what that is, the brothers have a group of us, and what we do, and I didn't know this. All the years I've been on Joe, I did not know this. When you see the brothers down out there on the field with either their outline or their manuscript, there is a brother up in the booth, up in the chairman's office. He has an identical copy of either the outline or, in my case, a manuscript. And your job is to take a number two pencil and you follow this brother word for word. And if he misses a word, you circle it. If he adds a word, you add it into the notes on the side. At the end of the brother's talk down the field, he will then walk off the stage and get in the elevator or the steps and come all the way up to the chairman's office. You will give your review of what he was doing with his talk to typically someone who's been assigned, and they're going to talk to this brother. And that is the way it is done. And the reason why, because they don't want anyone going off script. Every speaker, someone is following them. I had an experience, brother when I was at Bethel, he was my mentor. It was R.P. Johnson, the short brother. He was a society's troubleshooter. They used to call him Little Man, where he carries a big stick. And he did, because he used to go out for the society and he would delete elders around the spot, reappoint elders around the spot. This was long before they allowed the circuit overseers to do this. So R.P. is a troubleshooter. And so R.P. was telling me a story that happened to him once, is that there had been a change in the outline, and they got the wrong copies mixed up. He had the newest copy, who was when he was down the field. The guy who was the reader had the wrong copy. And so they were up in the chairman's office watching him go off, literally off script. And they was getting ready to call the brothers down the sound booth, kill the mic, kill the mic, kill the mic. And someone realized this is the new outline. This is the new outline. Let it go, let it go. And so RP says when he got back, finished his talk, came upstairs, walked to the room, he said they was laughing at you. They said, man, we almost cut you off, man. We almost cut you off. So you see this other side. And so this was something that I did. I was a reader. I followed whoever the speaker was. If he was going off route, you know, they would end up killing the mic. So, I mean, this is part of the chairman's office. I think Lady C has aspect from the ladies' side of what it's like to be in the chairman's office in comparison to other sisters who are not.
Well, I'm going to tell you right now, because we were so young.
Yeah.
I didn't feel, I knew people, like I remember the district overseer and his wife, and well, I don't want to mention people's names, but this particular district overseer was my district overseer in Michigan, and dynamic speaker, and he and his wife were in, they were there in the chairman's booth and stuff, and then just past the just usual, you know, high and whatever, high and by. I didn't feel comfortable being in the chairman's office because I felt like this was a group of people that was in a different league.
Oh, they were?
Okay. So I didn't feel comfortable being there.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I told you this or not, but I was literally scared to leave the chairman's office in that little area. It was a nice little size area that we were in because I was afraid they weren't going to let me back in. I was like, this has got to be a mistake. We're not supposed to be in here, and nobody else knows it. And if I leave out of here, I'm not going to be able to get back in. So I didn't really feel comfortable leaving. So I remember we had our own bathroom facilities, too. And because of where we were stationed at, because we were in Richmond, Virginia, at the one that we were at. But it was so funny because it was like they even bought our food. Because this was during a time when they were still serving food and everything there. But when you look back on it, these are supposed to be my brothers and sisters, right? So why didn't I feel comfortable? You know, I felt just so. And then there was this, I'm going to tell you what. One year we were there, the one circuit overseer, and one of the elders in our congregation. And we were standing. We were not in the chairman's office at the time. We were someplace else where only the brothers could go, the brothers and sisters could go. The people who were running the convention.
It was a chairman.
That particular one. Well, that day was a different chairman's office.
Actually, wasn't a chairman. We was actually, at that time, we was actually in news service. We went up to news service.
Okay. Well, anyway, we were there, and they were telling dumb blonde jokes. And I was standing there like, what? You know, because the brother, I don't want to mention names, but the brother who was in our sister congregation, his wife was a blonde. And so the circuit overseer and his wife, the circuit overseer was saying dumb blonde jokes to the brother's wife in our congregation. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, I felt so uncomfortable being around them. It was crazy.
Yeah.
But it was like, for me, I could care less if I would have been sitting in a chairman's office at all. I could care less of that. But that one year we were in the chairman's office, there was a single circuit overseer that was there. And he was trying to get into the chairman's office because all the single sisters was chasing him around.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes, I got to get in here. I got to get out. But it was so funny because we thought he was silly. See, we thought he was silly.
He was silly, but he was single.
He told us why.
He was a man.
He told us why he was acting silly, because he was trying to get them off of his back.
Okay.
Because remember,
he
came to our congregation to give a talk.
Oh, God.
Too. I'm kind of, you know, going off script here with this convention thing. But this circuit overseer, he came to our congregation, gave a talk. And when he came back out to his car, there was a bunch of sisters that had left their phone number on the windshield.
It was messed up.
On the windshield of his car. But one of our YouTube subscribers had contacted us, and I was talking to her on the phone, and she knew who he was, and she said he finally got married. So I guess he's not running from the sisters anymore.
that's the one the sister told, can I butter your bread? Oh, Lord, excuse me. Right. I butter your bread. That's all right. But yeah, and so one of the most interesting things about working in the chairman's office, how, you know, as a witness kid, I used to get popped upside the head. Pay attention. Wake up. You know, that kind of stuff, right? And so you always was told you have to be focused on the assembly. You know, don't go to the bathroom and don't be walking the halls. All this kind of stuff, right? Up there in the chairman's office, and this is what we, and this, and this wasn't just like a fluke. This was every time we worked there. I would listen. Actually, you know, we would look at each other like, I don't know. I would listen to the conversations that the women were having, or the circuit seals, and then the DO, and guys who came down from Bethel or some missionary. Their conversations had nothing to do with what was going on in the field. Nothing. In fact, they will be back there. They would oftentimes be back there discussing, yes, you know, I had the chance to go on the cruise with, I had one couple of brothers. They provided me and my wife the opportunity to go on the cruise down in the Caribbean. And I remember this one brother, he said, yes, we went out and we came back into the room and I looked on the bed and they had folded the bed back and they had pieces of chocolate, you know. You know, my wife, she had left her slip out. She left her little slip out and we came back in the room and they had made it into like a little flowers. And I tell you, and this is the kind of, and this is how they was carrying on. I'm like, no, Jehovah, Jesus, Moses, organization, it was just laid back. Like you said about the food, we didn't stand no lines. We, at lunchtime, in fact, in some of the facilities, they had a refrigerator in there. So it was bottled water, everything. So, and throughout the entire program, what they would do is they would take an order. Everybody, what y'all want? And everybody, you know, make up the laws. Then we'd give it to one of the security guys outside and say, you know, bring a box of this back. And they would come back with hoagies, sodas, anything you wanted. And we put it in the refrigerator and stacked the refrigerator. And we filled the refrigerator. So throughout the entire convention, if you wanted the juice, if you wanted the Coke, and what's the other Shasta? What's that? Lemon lime? Lemon lime. Yeah, lemon lime.
cheese Danish. And the hoagies. And all
if
that.
You wanted that, you just went over there, got yours, and came back, sat down, and just sat there and watched out there. And you got the friends out there suffering and dying. And I'm like, oh, man, this is how the other half lives. And so
it's amazing when people are in leadership roles,
oh, man.
You know, they never follow the prescription
or the
outlines of what everybody else does. Just look at corporate America.
Yeah.
You know, you have an office that you work in and the people that are in the leadership roles, like at where I work at, all of our leaders in our office, all the upper management, they get free parking because it comes with our lease. It's a perk. And so they get free parking, they get all these different things that you would never get, and you don't know all that's going on because they're the people that's running the office, running the show.
Yeah.
The same is true with the Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah.
Whoever runs the show, they get a chance to do what they want. I'm going to deviate on this too. One of the things I always knew, I'm going to out you, JT. One of the things I always remembered whenever we would go give a talk at other congregations, JT would march me up to the front of the Kingdom Hall, okay? And I told him, I said, because, he's giving the talk. JT giving the talk, right? So he want to sit at the front of the Kingdom Hall. And for that whole hour, I'm going to be sitting up there by myself because he's on stage giving the talk. I'm already nervous. I don't want to be there and all that. I'm nervous. You got me sitting in the front so you know everybody's looking at you. That's how we always felt, right? So then after JT would give the talk, he would come off the platform and he would go to the back and he would be there for the whole Watchtower study talking to one of the brothers that was an elder in that congregation.
We were taking care of elder business.
Yeah, right. So anyway, so I'm just throwing it out there. So then I remember that one time we went to a congregation and JT started going to the front of the Kingdom Hall. I said, oh, no, we not. I said, we're not going to no front of no Kingdom Hall to sit. Well, I'm sitting here by myself for 2 hours, and you're on stage giving the talk, and then you go to the back, and you're talking to the brothers there. And so I remember going to North Carolina one time, and he's giving a talk in one of his, not his congregation, but in the congregation, you know, like 25 minutes away.
My old pioneer partner congregation was at Bethel.
So it was so funny because, you know, now this time I'm there with JT's mom and his brothers and all that. So I got, you know, like I got like I have like people that's right there with me sitting with me.
They got your back.
They got my back, right? So I remember same old. We're sitting there listening to JT's talk, And then JT gets off the stage, you know, and he goes to the back of the Kingdom Hall and we don't see him again. And so his mother nudged me and she said, "Where is JT?" And I just looked at her and I said, "He's back there probably talking to one of the brothers." But see, people who are in this kind of a leadership, they don't have to follow the rules and they don't get in trouble. So if that was me back there talking to somebody in the lobby, they would have told me to get back to my seat.
Sister.
But these brothers, they don't have to do that. Yeah. So you sisters out there, y'all call your husbands on the carpet if he's back there talking in the back room. Because you know what? Later on, I found out from JT. Tell him, JT, why you were back there. Tell him.
Who's handling elder business?
Tell the real reason.
Who's back there gossiping? I'm sorry, elder business. I mean elder business. Elder business. Yeah, it is. So the meetings are boring. Everybody knows that. Even though kids, to be honest, and the king, you know, the king has no clothes on. Kids will tell you the meetings are boring. But grown folks, you got to act like the meetings are not boring. That's just the way it is. So this is an excuse that elders use when they want to get up. Elders get up, walk in the back, go into the office, do busy work, you know. Or like in my case, when we would go visit a congregation, you know, the brothers would call you in the back, you'd be talking, and y'all would just be telling stories. And because this particular congregation was the same congregation that my old pioneer partner was in, as he was at also at Bethel, but he had left, and we went back to North Carolina, and we visited the hall. He said, "Hey, you give a talk, JT." I said, "All right, hook me up, man, hook me up." So we're back there catching up, man. "Yeah, man, you know, so-and-so, yeah, I heard he got married. Yeah, they're in the circuit break now, you know." So you're back there just jawboning.
And meanwhile, I'm at my seat.
Yeah, you ask the question. So those are the kind of things that you see. And it gives you a perspective of how things work. And so once I started becoming more involved on the regional or the district level, then you begin to see that the same thing applied to the circuit assembly, how individuals are selected to give talks. And typically, they're friends of either the circuit or, at this time, the district overseer. It's just that simple. It's not. My mom says, "No, Jehovah picked the brother to give the talk, even though somebody might be a..." And they just give you these crazy examples. You know, Moses was slow of tongue. He couldn't talk fast. And Jehovah used him. That's why they got Brother Johnson. He can't talk at all. And you're like, "Well, he can't talk. He put me to sleep." So, and that's the kind of crazy stuff that I grew up as a kid being told. Jehovah selected these guys down there on the platform. And then you get in the back room, you're like, "Brother Johnson, you want to hook him up and talk?" "Yeah, hook him up and talk. Yeah, I think he can handle that." And some of it was really interesting. To hear some of the conversations is really amazing. For example, I remember asking my mentor, when you were out in the traveling work and, you know, and everything, did you run into an issue with selecting speakers? And he gave me a very interesting example of how it could work. He said, let's say, for example, you're going through this. What happened? The society sends either the circuit or, at that time, the district overseer, a list of open slots. Now, there's some slots that the society is going to fill with a Bethel speaker. If a Bethelite is traveling to a certain convention and he is a Bethel elder, then he's going to get certain slots automatically because he's going to bring the greetings from Bethel. So he may not get the public talk or the keynote address, but generally speaking, he will be on the program. He'll bring the greetings from Bethel. You know, Bethel brings greetings, bros, out here in the hour, you know, that kind of stuff. And so what would happen is they have to fill in these slots. I've seen the form. You fill in the slots. The who's going to have the opening prayer, the first talk, second talk, who had the prayer for lunch. It's all society organized. This is how we know all this information about the society. They know what's going on. So he would fill in the slot of who the brothers were. Well, he said, for example, you have a brother, circuit overseer. He's making up his list, sitting at home, making up his list. He has one slot left. He has two brothers he's thinking about put him on this program. It's nothing really heavy. It's just a prayer. Nothing big. Just a prayer. One brother has taken him and his wife, both, bought him two or three suits, bought his wife two or three dresses. The other brother is a regular pioneer, broke as dirt, But he's a regular party. He's a spiritual man of God. Now, he said, JT, he said, now, who do you think the average circle of sin is going to get at prayer in part two? It's going to be the guy that bought him the suits. It's going to be the guy that bought him the suits. Because it's not a heavy-duty part. It's a simple part, Brother Stones. We'd like to pray before for lunch tomorrow. And so it's done.
But you know what, though, JT? And as we're talking about what we remember about conventions, mm-hmm. it's like if there was a brother that, you know, that was all he did was give a prayer.
Oh.
It was almost like he tried to turn it into a public talk.
Oh.
And so I remember, you know, being a kid and, you know, they don't went over. Because when I remember back in the day when they had these conventions, they would just go over. I mean, you could be there. You haven't eaten since, like, what, lunchtime? And I remember my mom and dad going to take us out to fast food. This is when fast food was really good and fast food was really
Jack in the box, Jack
but,
in the box.
Hey, look, kids really did, you know, get fast food and it was really a treat, right? So it was McDonald's. We used to like McDonald's fish fillet. And as a little kid, I was like, oh, my God, we're getting ready to get out of here. And we're going to go get something to eat. My stomach is growling. And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't wait to get out of here. And the prayer turns into like 10, 15 minutes.
Yes.
And then based on what you're saying, it's like, okay, so I got it. He didn't get a part on the assembly. So now he's giving a 15-minute prayer.
Yes.
And as a little kid, you're like, are you going to, is he going to say amen? And I remember I interviewed this sister named Linda. And in the video, during our interview, she was talking about how they couldn't wait to get back to go to the hotel to go swimming. And she said that's what she remembered about the prayers, is that they were so long, is that she said she remembers sitting there saying, say amen. Hurry up. Come on. Say amen. Say amen. Because she wanted to get back to the hotel before the pool closed. And so we were dying laughing when I was interviewing her, and she was saying that about how she would say amen, just say amen.
Yeah.
You know, because anybody who's listening to this video knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah. In fact, that's why some, over the years, some of the guys who set up the schedule, they actually just make a decision. We're going to have the brother who gave the talk also close. Because he's been talking for 30, 40 minutes, so he's already tired. So he's not going to drag it on. And like Lady C mentioned, if this is this guy's only part, he's going to make it into a public talk. And so it's very unfortunate. I think back to, like you mentioned, about the women. I know at most conventions in the summertime, they would put paper over the mirror in the sister's bathroom. Yeah. And you always get that one sister like, that's all right. I'm going to tear this little piece right here so I can see myself. And they will always tear a little piece. And as it went on, it just kept tearing more and more. And after a while, you had full-length mirrors. But
remember that was so crazy. You would go in there and they didn't want the sisters in there styling and profiling. And so they would put the paper over the mirror so that you couldn't look at yourself in the mirror.
I know, right?
As if to say, like, you know, what if I got something in my nose? What if I'm trying to take care of something personal? And now you've taken that right, or you've made an assumption that doesn't even exist, because you're looking at me and thinking, just something natural. I can't even imagine going to a convention for my job, going into the bathroom, and the mirrors are covered. I mean, that was hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
But interestingly, up in the chairman's office, there was no paper covering the mirror. But I mean, it's really interesting. And so over the years, the way the organization, when they moved away from the food arrangement because of the tax issue, I remember the friends would, during intermission, the friends would go out into the community or in the area to try and get something to eat. And of course, if you release, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people into a mall or whatever, you know, it's going to back up the lunch and everything. And so eventually they started telling the witnesses, you know, bring your own food, you know, bring your cooler so we can get the meeting started on time. And so, I mean, it's this constant, we're going to treat you like a child because we look at you as a child. And that's kind of where you have, what you have.
But remember, JT, so after they stopped selling the food mm-hmm. at the conventions, mm-hmm. and I remember Pioneers, they used to get their tickets free.
Man, yeah.
I remember getting mine free, you know? And, but I remember how when they stopped serving the food and people didn't have to buy those food tickets and then they would go get them, people, and they were doing a complete donation arrangement.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
We would see people, because remember they had the fruit, they had the fruit bags.
Fruit basket, a little bag.
They had the Danish, they had the cola, and the what's the other one called? Lemon lime soda.
Lemon lime.
And they had the hoagies and all the chips,
Egg muffin.
Muffin egg.
Sorry,
right?
McDonald's. Sorry about that.
So, remember the family that we saw?
Lots of family.
They were like toting just bags.
You thought they went to Safeway or a Food Line or something. They came back with bags of.
Yes.
And they put about $2 in the bag in the container.
They might not have put that in there. But yeah, it became such a problem.
They had to stop. They had to stop.
Then just kind of like deviating from that part. Remember when we had to pay for the literature? And I remember that when they went to the complete donation arrangement with that literature, how people were at the back of the Kingdom Hall ordering bound volumes that went back to the 60s. And this is like in the 90s. And they were ordering like 20 years worth of bound volumes. And we went to Bethel, because when you would go to Bethel, Bethel had a literature counter. Yeah. Where you could just go there, but this is during a time when you had to actually pay for your literature. So they had the brother back there manning the counter. You go back there, you'd ask for whatever book you wanted, and then you would be able to get your literature. But when they took that to the complete donation arrangement, they had to shut that down. Because people were just going back there, just picking up stuff and taking off with it, and you know, just literally just taking all kind of literature. So the society was like losing a lot of money. At that time.
Now.
You know?
Yeah. And what made it so ironic, these were all Christians, true Christians. But what you found is witnesses, they cheap and they'll steal if they can. And so that's really what it was. And that was why the society basically stopped that. The witnesses were not contributing, quote unquote, in proportion to what they were taking. And because I was the accounts overseer, we literally saw it reflected in the contributions. When the society first went to the donation arrangement and they were still allowing people to get food at the assemblies and allow them to get literature, the number of bound volumes. I remember people would order like what was called deluxe Bibles with the leather, the black Bible, the gold trim. They were all like, they get their Bible study. I mean, and of course, the contributions didn't reflect. And so the society walked in and said, we shutting that down. This is a business. We need y'all to pay for this stuff. You ain't ordering nothing. And today, you have to get a lot of literature approved. You have grown people who came and order literature. They have to go ask the elders, oh, Brother Johnson, can you please let me get some? You know, and so they treat their members like children. I mean, they treat them like children.
But you know what? That was a really bad time for pioneers, because a lot of pioneers, you know, they lived off of those placements of those magazines because they would give us 50% off. So when they stopped the donation arrangement, that also cut into the regular pioneers and stuff too, because they were making them feel guilty for keeping the donation. So like before, you knew, I picked up my magazines, it cost me $20. When a regular pioneer picked up their magazines and the whole thing cost $20, they got a discount. And the discount was $10. So they didn't have to pay full price for their magazines. So basically, they got 50% discount on the Watchtower magazines and books. So imagine, if you had 10 books, $10, you only paid $5 for that. So that when you went to go place those books in the field and understand place, they called it place when it's really sold, okay? they didn't want to say that we sold the books, but they say place. When you place these books, you know, it's one of those trigger words. So they picked up the books, they got 10 books, they only paid $5 for it. So when they sold the books, they made a $5 profit.
50% discount.
Hey, all of you people who sell Mary Kay and multi-level marketing. And I remember when my mother-in-law was selling Mary Kay, and let's say a tube of lipstick cost, you know, $10. Well, Mary Kay allowed her to have $5 of that. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same way Watchtower was. So it's just like any business transaction. So when the Watchtower ended up getting rid of the selling arrangement, when it went to a complete donation arrangement, now, I remember in our congregation, pioneers were really frustrated because they were saying, okay, now before I knew what I was supposed to pay to pick up my magazines. So now what do I do? And so the word on the street or the buzz was like, you're not getting this 50% off anymore. They're making them feel guilty, you know?
I remember the Kingdom Ministry came out with a question at the time, should we leave the literature for free? Should we just give it away for free? And the society was very clear. We don't give away literature for free. We do not want people getting the impression that our literature is free.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of, as we all know, because of the tax issue, the Jimmy Swaggart Ministries and so forth, society was literally forced to go to the donation rate. And as a result, they have lost a lot of revenue, just a tremendous amount of revenue.
And I remember this one time we were at the Kingdom Hall meeting for service, and one of our elders was there. And the Watchtower had this big old thing about having a pouch. We want you to have a purse, a pouch, or something, so that when people are out in field service and you take the money for the donation, they did not want you to show the householder or the person at the door that you are putting this money in your physical wallet or purse. So they wanted people to say, here's the pouch I'm putting this in. So they got one of the circuit overseer got one of the elders in our congregation out in field service one morning, and he was like quizzing to find out if we were ready for that. And he really embarrassed him in front of the whole group because he was like, no, brother, where is your pouch? You know, and so he's from the back. He's like, so I think it wasn't Mike doing it? He was sitting in the group. I don't know what it was.
Mike was standing in the back.
He was standing in the back, and he was asking him about where was his pouch. And we had like 50 people at the Kingdom Hall for service that morning. And he was like going off on this elder about, where's your pouch, brother? Where's your pouch? You know, how are you going to show the householder that, you know, this is a donation? And I was like, this is crazy. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. It became such an issue that actually ended up becoming part of either a letter or I think it was in the Kingdom Ministry about, are we paying double for the literature? And of course, anybody who knows how to count knows that you're actually paying double. But the Watchtower, because of their smooth words, they just brush it aside. And it's very sad how they play with words, but yeah, you're paying it double because not only do you pay for it, then you get the household to make a contribution and you bring their contribution back and you give it all back. So you put a dollar in and the household put a dollar in. And so everybody realized we're paying twice for this literature. But the society wrote this nice little letter, this nice little, I think it was a question box, and they just smoothed round over and the witnesses went on back to sleep. I mean, gotta love it.
So times have changed from when we were at the in the organization. And I remember when I did our video back down memory lane, and it was so funny because the comments that we received from that video, and I was talking about how the Watchtower used to have a subscription, and I remember somebody commenting and saying, are they even telling the truth? Are we even telling the truth about whether the Watchtower had a subscription to the Watchtower in Awake? But, you know, there's a lot of people that have become Jehovah's Witnesses in the last 20 years. And so everything that we're talking about in this video is like a history lesson for people to just understand, you know, to understand where they've come from in the realm of how they held their assemblies and stuff.
Yeah.
Because before our time, they had 9-day conventions.
Yeah.
You know? 9-day conventions. So glad I wasn't there. And can you imagine a 9-day convention? All I remember is we used to have 4-day conventions during our time.
We was growing up as kids, yeah.
Four days. Mm-hmm. Then they cut it down to 3 days.
3 days.
And when I thought about how these brothers had a 9-day convention, I thought about how people were losing their jobs trying to take off for the Thursday and Friday session. Mm-hmm. And for people who worked weekends, they could have lost their job too because everybody don't work Monday through Friday. Mm-hmm. So then I thought to myself, man, what happened to the brothers who was trying to go to a 9-day convention? Imagine that. Yeah. You know, it just makes you think about how this religion has put people through guilt trips, making them think that if they're not there, they're not spiritual. Jehovah's going to be with you, you know, and just all these crazy things just to go to a convention where information has changed, and a lot of information that was taught at those conventions where those people lost their jobs,
mm-hmm.
you would be considered an apostate today.
Yeah, that's for sure.
If you believe that stuff.
Yeah.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah. People lost their jobs. I mean, and some, depending on where you live at, you have, I mean, the stories are just crazy. You would think that since there were conventions in other, had other dates or in other areas, that the witness could simply say, well, I'm not going to go to our convention. I'll go to another assembly later on. And for many, that's what they did. But it's interesting that depending on where you live, what the elders are like in your area, they could guilt trip you. They could literally guilt trip you to death. And so you have elders who would give talks at the meeting when they would read the dates, and they'll say, "Now, brothers, what date are you assigned? This is when Jehovah has assigned you. He's assigned you to attend the convention the first weekend of the month, not the last weekend. Are you working with Jehovah's Witness?" And so you have people who be like, "Well, I might lose my job, brother, but I can go to that." And so they just guilt trip people. I mean, this organization can beat you to death. and so you would have in some places, like where Lady C worked at, she worked for a company that had literally probably about 20 Jehovah's Witnesses work there, if not more. And so everybody couldn't get off for the same week. But once again, depending on who the elders were in your hall, they could guilt trip you to death. And so people have to risk their jobs and stuff. And of course, you always heard those stories about, you know, brother came back and then he lost his job, but he got a better job. You always heard those stories. They never told you the one about the brothers who were still unemployed, you know. So,
that's right.
You know, what about the guys who lost their job? And of course, you know, the society didn't help you out, the congregation didn't help you out. So it's just one of those things when you look back at the conventions. The conventions were indeed big, big money makers. And we did a video on the circuit assembly. And if you haven't had a chance to take a look at it, take a look at the assembly. It deals with how we always have a deficit at the circuit assembly because of the type of money that the way it's raised, the way it's structured in the program. And so at the major conventions in the summertime, those are just huge money makers. So it must be very interesting for the society this year.
So anyway, this has been Lady C.
This has been JT.
And we want to thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Critical Thought.
This program was sponsored by Critical Thinkers.